Well, we mentioned protests there and what results they yield, but another form of protest we've been seeing in recent days and weeks is anti-immigration protests. They were on the streets of Dublin again over the weekend, although it must be said there were also people marching in favour of diversity and against racism. But the anti-immigration march went through the city centre. It stopped outside media offices and a hotel housing people seeking international protection. Jack, you were at one in Finglas last week, and there was an interesting array in some of the quotes you had in your piece in the Irish Times on Saturday as to the motivation of as to why people were there.
Yeah, I think it was messy and it was confusing. At times it was quite ugly. There were some pretty reprehensible sentiments expressed at times, but like I don't think you could neatly describe the any one particular viewpoint as being overly represented, other than the fact that like when an anti-immigration viewpoint was articulated, it tended to be well received. But there was all sorts of stuff being said at the microphone. You know, there was kind of these strange quasi-legal Freeman on the land ideologies being spoken about. You know, people saying don't recognise the power of the courts, or if a guard offers you a statute, you have to demand that it be written in the old Irish script and stuff like that. And then there was clear, you know, dissatisfaction and impatience emanating from the crowd about that as well. People at some points turning around and just saying, you know, whatever about the government, we're here for the immigrants. And there was no particular candle held for the opposition either. I mean, Sinn Féin, strangely enough, were criticised as well quite a lot. It wasn't, in fact, more so than the government that I heard. Sinn Féin were strongly criticised. And, you know, I think that this protest movement that's growing, it's inchoate, it's messy, it's confusing. But as I say, it's also very ugly and it's very politically volatile, because at one point, someone did stand up and address the crowd. A masked man addressed the crowd and said, I'll leave out the swear words, but said, you know, we have to burn these people out. And that was a sentiment that people didn't walk away from or disown. It was a sentiment that was cheered. So I think that there is something troubling underlying all this. I mean, it remains to be seen exactly the scale of this protest movement. I'm not sure that we're approaching anything like what we saw with the water charges protests, but like I think it's something that's larger, for example, than the anti-vax protests that we saw during COVID or the anti-lockdown protests. So it's an extremely volatile situation. It's hard to know which way it's going to go in, and it's very difficult to know how politics writ large, not just the government or the opposition or independents, how politics reacts to this, how it not accommodates it, but perhaps how it confronts it.
Lynn Boylan, as Jack Horgan-Jones mentions there, that a lot of the anger at some of these protests has been directed towards your party. Why is that in your analysis? What is your part in considering this? You know, Desi Ellis's office, there were protests outside of that, and Mary Lou McDonald's name was being chanted in some of the East Wall protests. Why is your party the lightning rod, do you think?
Well, I think that those who are of the far right and who are orchestrating some of these, and while I say that Jack is right, there are people there from communities who have genuinely frustrated with government policy, and then you have deeply unsavoury characters who are of the far right. They've been targeting me since I was involved in Ibrahim Halawa's campaign. I've had death threats and hangman nooses sent to me. So it doesn't surprise me that they would be continuing to target Sinn Féin. I suppose they see that maybe certain communities are more receptive to messages and that they're trying to target our votes. But for me, when it comes to those individuals who are stoking up anger, who are talking about burning people out of their homes, in some cases have set fire to buildings, this goes beyond party politics. This requires everybody from the communities, from all of the political spectrum, to come together to resist that type of narrative and far right getting any stronger than it already is, because some of us have been warning for a long time that they were growing in strength because people were giving them oxygen. We're talking about both sidesism. Now, they're a small number and they are whipping up fear and they are spreading a lot of misinformation. You then do have people who are in communities who are deeply, deeply frustrated and deeply angry because of the housing crisis, because of all of the mismanagement of the health services, access to schools. So what I'm saying, and we are doing this conversation by conversation, door by door, talking to, in some cases, it's family members and friends. You have to have calm conversations and say, it's protesting outside where somebody is seeking shelter. is not going to fix the fact that your child can't get a house. They're completely separate issues. If you want that frustration to be targeted and to be effective, then you take it to Leinster House and you take it to where the decision makers are. But we all need to show leadership when it comes to this issue, because the rhetoric that is out there on social media is actually terrifying.
Michael Ealy-Ray, when you're canvassing in your constituency, or when people are coming to your clinic, have you heard anything different in recent months about the kind of concerns that have been raised at you, any of the kind of exotic conspiracy theories like Jack was talking there, or even anger being directed at immigrants? And if so, what kind of a role do you have in having a conversation with people?
Well, first of all, I did read what Jack Horgan-Jones wrote about the protests, and I read it very, very closely, because reading what he said, it was the same as being there. You got the whole flavour of the different speeches, and it was very well put together, to be honest. But I'll tell you about my own experience in a place that's very dear to me, which is obviously the town of Killarney. And you know that Killarney has made headlines for all the right reasons over the years, because we're the tourism capital of the world and it's the finest premier tourism town everywhere.
Plug Julian and, Sertant.
There's no place like it.
No,
and
indeed.
We have had an issue that has arisen there, because there's been a number of incidents, and there was what I would call genuine concern, and not the what I would call the nastiness that Jack had to report on, and we'll say the worrying undertones of some of the speeches that he referenced there. But I'm talking about people of the town of Killarney and its environs who were saying, what is happening here? Is there not too much of a concentration of people in one place that we don't have services? And I'm talking about highly respectable people coming out, for instance, on Radio Kerry, like, for instance, from the medical side of things, and doctors coming out and saying, we don't have the resources in this town to deal medically with the amount of people that are there.
It's also an economic question for Killarney, though, as well, isn't it?
Of course, you're right, Jack, that there's that side of it, that it's a tourism town. And if we have hundreds and hundreds of bed spaces in hotels taken up, is that right for the town of Killarney?
Well, is it
going to have a serious knock-on effect to other businesses, smaller businesses that have mushroomed around the hotel industry? So these are genuine concerns, because those small businesses, for example, they're the people who give the jobs to the people in the summertime, be it full-time or part-time jobs. So you can't blame people for having concerns and for saying, well, why aren't we notified? Why aren't we consulted? Why isn't there more of a discussion? Say, for instance, people that
I'm just going to move to Christopher O'Sullivan there, because your colleague, John McGuinness, is calling for the use of a hotel to be paused in the case of Kilkenny until there's adequate consultation with Kilkenny County Council and the local communities. I mean, is that something you would put that you would share those kind of concerns, or are you disappointed with your colleague saying that? Is he flagging concerns he's seeing on the ground and through the right channels in saying this, or would you be uncomfortable with that?
No, I appreciate one of the messages coming through here is in terms of greater consultation and greater communication. And I haven't seen John's comments, but I imagine he's looking for consultation, which I think communities.
I'll tell you exactly what his comments were. He said that the housing of people in a hotel should be put on hold. He says it is unacceptable that there would have been no consultation with the local communities, or indeed with Kilkenny County Council. We want to do our bit for both the Ukrainian population who are being displaced, and indeed for those coming to Ireland for protection under the International Protection Programme. But this is simply too much, and there is a need, I believe, to pause this. He was speaking to KCR at the time.
Yeah, and I'm not sure, he's just stressed that there's a need to accommodate Ukrainians. He said that, but I'm not sure exactly of his concerns. I imagine if you do have town centre hotels, Michael was talking about there, John was talking about, sometimes they are very important in terms of the economic viability of the centre of a town. But at the same time, we are firefighting here in terms of the numbers of Ukrainian refugees and people seeking international protection. So all options have to be explored and have to be made available. And if I could just come back to the commentary and the misinformation, and I absolutely agree with Lynn that there needs to be a cross-party approach in terms of tackling that misinformation, and that would include, you know, help from the likes of Michael as well, who's obviously very influential, and that is to tackle that misinformation. So, I mean, it's there on two different scales. You have, you know, at some of the protests, you hear accusations of, you know, that an increase in immigrants coming to your area will lead to an increase in murder, in rape, in attacks. There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever to base that in, and that's something that we have to tackle. But on maybe a more minor scale, but can be just as eroding in terms of confidence, is when you hear things like, you know, Ukrainian refugees are taking all our social houses. That's absolutely not the case, and there's no basis.
It's not the case in social housing. That's true, because the refugee accommodation effort has not really bled across into the private rental sector, the social housing sector. But it is putting pressure on services, and that's not the verdict of the far right.
It's putting pressure on services, but it's the verdict of the government's own briefing. I want to tackle a misnomer and misinformation that has been put out there, because luckily in Cork, so West, where I'm from, we have been able to allocate a number of social houses over the last year. And as TDs and councillors, we get informed and we get notified of every single allocation. And not one social house has gone to a Ukrainian yet. This is one of the comments that we all hear in our constituency. Right. And I'm sure you hear too,
is
that
they're taking our
houses. And these are the type of tropes that we have to tackle.
Michael,
all of
right,
together.
You want to come back in there?
I just want to make one point, and it's the thing that an awful lot of people up and down the length and breadth of the country are asking. We can all understand and have nothing but sympathy for what has happened to the Ukrainian people that have had to flee here, that had to leave their homes, leave all their possessions and come here and go to other places around Europe. And we can understand that. But what is difficult to understand, if you take other countries where there is not war, and where people are leaving and coming here, is something like 570% of an increase in 12 months. You would have to ask yourself the question, why are people, we'll call them economic refugees, why are they coming here in massive numbers where they weren't coming here before? And what is so attractive about Ireland versus any place else? You have to pass an awful lot of places to come to Ireland. If you look at where we are on the map, they have to pass an awful lot of other places before they land here. And it's only a fair question to say, why is that allowed to happen? And the other thing that's a very fair question to ask is, why would a person land here and not have any type of travel documents, any passport? What happens to the passport if they get on at the other side and have a passport? Where does it disappear when they land?
I think you asked a very good question there. Why would someone travel so far through so many countries? You know, surely they're escaping something.
But if they are, I'd like to have that explained to me in greater detail. And if you can explain,
I take your point. And
I'm not arguing. 570% of an increase.
Right. Well, it also has to be pointed in terms of the zero sum game that the number of new asylum seekers who've been left without state provided accommodation has now risen to 109, and that there's a homelessness issue there. But on that issue that Michael Healy Ray is talking about, Lynn Boylan, people asking questions about people arriving in the state with
legitimate questions,
no documents or whatever. Are they the kind of questions that are being raised? And in terms of the efficiency or otherwise of the asylum processing system, does your party have any concerns about that in terms of providing answers to some of those issues being raised?
There is a process in place, and people are, as far as I'm aware, are fingerprinted when they arrive into the country and details are taken about them. People should have decisions made quickly, absolutely. But like when you're talking about decisions being made and people are languishing in direct provision centres when we've accepted that that's an inhumane approach to warehousing people, and they're languishing there because they haven't been able to move out and move into the community. But look, like Michael is coming across very reasonable, but he is throwing out some of the information that's being used to whip up fear, and that's the reality.
I know asking questions is not whipping up fear.
You know, we all just say we're only just asking questions.
I will let you back in. What specific issue has Michael Healy Ray raised
that you said was wrong? I asked questions that are on everybody's lips.
People who come into this country have an international we have an international obligation to assess their claims if they're seeking asylum or if they're fleeing war. And those claims will be assessed and then they will get a decision. And that is for, I suppose, the function of the state to carry that out. When you talk about, because there's no direct flight here or, you know, people destroying documents, you have to ask a question is, why would people who are so terrified of, I suppose, being returned back to where they've come from, that they would go to those lengths? And that's, they're the questions you have to ask. Why are people doing that? It's the same as, why are people getting into really dangerous boats and travelling across the Mediterranean to try and seek a better quality of life, to flee from war, LGBT community when they know that they could face the death penalty.
Let's go back to Michael Ealy. You raised a number of questions there. You're a public representative, Michael Ealy. Couldn't you get the answer to those questions and then feed those questions back to your constituents when they asked? Well, you could ask parliamentary questions of any minister in government and find the information with the research resources that are provided to you through Oireachtas Éireann.
Well, first of all, I just have to say to what Lynn said there, to insinuate in any shape or fashion that anything that I've said here was wrong or that there was anything wrong with the questions or the way I portrayed them, you're wrong, because that is blatantly wrong and it's unfair of you to even insinuate such a thing, because the questions I asked are questions that journalists ask, that the people, the taxpayers, the people up and down the length and breadth of the country are asking those type of questions. And if you are not willing to listen to that or take that on board, well, you're
Michael,
off of side then.
Michael, but I'm going to finish.
I'm going to finish. You ask me a question and I answer it. The minister has come out recently and said himself that he has worries about the fact of people arriving here with no travel documentation whatsoever and no passports. And I think that's a very legitimate question. And to have somebody take umbrage to
I just want to bring into Jack Horgan-Jones' reference a government briefing document there earlier.
A few of them, actually. I mean, there was papers presented to the Cabinet Subcommittee last week, which outlined, you know, the pressure on services, and they were in Minister Joe O'Brien's briefing papers as well. But just to zoom in for a second on the issue of people destroying papers, which I don't mean to minimise, or people arriving without papers, perhaps more properly it should be characterised as. I don't mean to minimise this, because it is an issue that deserves attention and it's one that has grown. There's about 5,000 people that fall into that category last year. But to focus in on that, I think, risks missing the real public policy challenge here, the really unprecedented one, which is accommodating 50, 60, 70,000, 80,000 and upwards people who are here either seeking international protection or fleeing the war in Ukraine over the coming years, you know, or over the last year and probably in the year to come as well. So I think that, like, while it is not unimportant, it does risk really distracting from that main policy challenge, which is something that the government, I think, has manifestly failed to move from. And I feel like, you know, I'm one of many people who've repeated this time and again ad nauseum, has failed to move from an emergency footing to a more sustainable one. And I don't think that anyone in government or outside of government would necessarily criticise the officials who've been working in the Department of Integration on this and have managed to conjure up, you know, enough beds to accommodate all these people throughout 2022. But, like, you know, where is the weight of accommodation options coming in behind that emergency response? How are we going to shift this policy stance? Okay. And what does a successful outcome actually look like here?
All right. Okay, well, we're going to give you the last word on that particular section. I'm going to go to a couple of texts here that have come in. I don't always agree with Mikey Healy. Ray, this is going back to our first topic. But on this, he's correct. I'm astounded that people who are in nursing care were deprived of disability payments. It is a moral issue, says June in Kildare. Somebody else encouraging people to read Conor O'Mahony, the former Special Rapporteur on Child Protection and lecturer in law in UCC. Please read Professor Conor O'Mahony's recent piece in the Sunday Business Post. What's lawful is not always ethical, says Nessa. And Tina, who's a nurse in Dublin 16, texts in to say it was policy of the government of the day to encourage private nursing homes. They got tax incentives to build them. There were few, if any, new public nursing homes built. Did patients have any choice at all but to avail of private care? That's the real issue, as I say, from Tina, a nurse in Dublin 16. We're going to look at the cost of living, specifically in the area of energy, and some bumper profits at the energy companies and a few other climate issues besides after this.